Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Greetings from the hill country of Central Texas. This is the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. We know that there are many podcasts competing for your time and attention. We hope to bring you the content and guests to be your go-to podcast for the study of war, warfare, and strategy. Thank you for listening, and we hope that you find this episode both entertaining and informative. Okay, welcome back to the Revolution of Military Affairs podcast. Today we're going in a slightly different direction, although it still falls within the war, warfare, and strategy focus of the podcast. Today we're going to talk with Sahar Muhammad Ali. Sorry for butchering your name there. Today we're going to talk with Sahar Muhammad Ali, and I'll give her the floor to let her talk about what it is she does, because her title is extremely long and I don't want to screw it up. So, Sahar, please introduce yourself, what it is you do.
Thanks, Amos. I am currently working as senior faculty associate at Defense Security Cooperation University that does training, advising, education on security cooperation related matters as part of the Defense Security Cooperation Agency within the Department of Defense. And I joined last summer as part of all of the new hires as part of this new Department of Defense policy on civilian harm mitigation. So I'm primarily training and teaching on civilian harm mitigation.
Okay. And as part of that, I guess we have to throw out the standard caveat that what you're saying is purely your own words and doesn't represent the Department of Defense or the agency that you work for.
That's correct. These are all my personal views and they do not reflect the Department of Defense.
Yep. And also before that, just for some context too, and I want to make sure I say this correctly, you worked at the Center for Civilians in Conflict, or CIVIC, as the director for Middle East and North Africa and Southeast Asia, correct? Doing similar work?
Yes, I worked for the, I was the regional director for MENA and South Asia, working on civilian harm mitigation, educating, training militaries on ways to minimize risk to civilians and civilian objects.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So with that background set, this is just for the audience. Sahar and I have indirectly, directly worked together, communicated together for several years now, just based off my own experience and work and writing on what I had seen and participated in, you know, working at the headquarters that oversaw the the Battle of Mosul. Sahara was actually on the ground a bit there throughout that conflict too. So we had different views of the same thing, and so you know, we communicated over the course of you know, I don't even remember, 2018, 2019 ish, throughout that period up to today. So it's been an enriching experience for me, because I did to be frank, I didn't know that the work that she does was a thing that existed before we started talking. As dumb as that may sound, but I guess that's probably typical for most people. So anyway, I guess with that backdrop laid there, Sahar, what are some of the main concerns for reducing civilian harm on the battlefield that have been identified in recent years based off your research?
No, thanks, Amos. And, you know, yeah, exactly. One of my key goals, and now as part of joining the DoD, is also like the education training piece across. So on these particular issues, and it's exciting now there's a new DoD policy on it. But the issues of, you know, when armed conflict and the, just as we see, you know, every year the Secretary General of the United Nations puts out its protection of civilians and armed conflict reports. The latest one will come out in May. And I think the data that is sort of reflected in there is pretty stark in terms of the millions of people that are being directly impacted by conflict. There are still currently 100 armed conflicts that are taking place. We don't even realize, I mean, there's certain conflicts that are in the headline news, like what's happening in Israel, Gaza, and in Sudan, and Ukraine, but there are other low-level to armed conflicts that are taking place across 60 countries with hundreds of non-state armed actors, and, you know, civilians are caught up in it. So they're, you know, so the data that comes out is death, injury, millions of people displaced, cannot access essential services, clean water, you know, medical, you know, anything related to you know, again, once they're injured, getting the proper medical treatment, food insecurity is affecting millions of people when conflict is happening. So the trend lines are pretty grim. And of course, this is not new. I mean, war has been around, but, right, you know, as we know, if we just go back from, again, at a big picture level, one of the, what we all trying to do, and states are trying to do, and citizens and civilians, we all trying to do, is how do you reduce and minimize harm to civilians when war does occur? And just to, you know, since I'm a lawyer, I always have to go back to, you know, the law a little bit, yeah. But, you know, after World War II, the Geneva Conventions were enacted, which sets the legal framework on trying to, you know, reduce, sets out the basic rules to protect civilians from the effects of hostilities, and, you know, to protect prisoners of wars, the wounded, mm-hmm. the sick, the shipwrecked, and why, you know, you want to not repeat the horrors of World War I and World War II. Right. And so I think there's the legal framework that both states, you know, countries, states have to abide by, but also some of these basic rules on to protect civilians and civilian objects also apply to non-state armed actors, even though they haven't signed these treaties, because some of these basic rules have become customary. So they're norms, and, you know, we need to encourage everybody to abide by these basic norms. Of course, some of the trends that we do see are there's lack of compliance to international humanitarian law, and there is just not, you know, different war is taking place in more densely populated areas, and, you know, that's how we started working together also. Right. Or sort of exchanging information is on how the trend lines in terms of urbanization means that, you know, the what was said is like you can bypass a city, it's no longer an option. And so when war does take place at your doorsteps, civilians are caught up and civilian infrastructure is impacted because of the kind of munitions that are being used. And when civilian infrastructure, so there's two kinds, obviously, as there's directly attacking civilians and civilian infrastructure which would be considered as violations of international humanitarian law. And so the obligation is, how do you minimize these incidental harms? And what are sort of creative ways to identify all the risks and, enact mitigation measures and training, et cetera? So it's not, everything's not doom and gloom. There are, which does seem like that. It is pretty horrific what we are reading on a daily basis. But there are also, we have to be positive and continue to innovate to see how we can do better.
Yeah, that's, I think it's, for one, the thing that I first wanted to comment on that you said is the number of conflicts that are going on. And I think that that's something that folks just either don't, aren't aware of or forget about is, right across the water there in Haiti, there's a significant conflict going on, and it's getting some play, in the news down in Florida and in DC a little bit, but that's a significant issue that's going on right there. And, these situations are going on all over the world all the time. And so it really is a significant problem that's persistent and isn't going away. And that's the thing about, war. We think when we use that word war, it's this big thing with tons of rockets and missiles and bombs going off. But, that word is sometimes not the best word. And I think that's why conflict or armed conflict is a better term in many cases, because it helps push down what it is, that mental model to something less big, if you will, so that people can conceptualize it a little better. But the other thing with that too is, as you said, conflict is becoming more urban for a variety of reasons. And, Tony King has written a ton about this, and I think it's all really good too. Cities are becoming bigger, militaries are becoming smaller, with technology becoming, giving states in many cases asymmetric advantages over other states, but also over non-state actors. Those people with the unasymmetric advantages seek to offset the asymmetric advantages within the confines of cities. And so they contract into cities to try and offset those, the ability to be seen, the ability to be heard. I'm using air quotes on heard, a lot of the cyber capabilities, the ability for precision munitions to be precise. And so that inevitably invites collateral damage and civilian casualties. And so there's that paradox where I think you guys are working to try and, offset those things, but then by virtue of the military trying to become more effective, it's actually working counterproductively almost in creating this paradox where it's contributing to the problem. So I guess that gets to my next question. Has the increase in precision strike seemed to offset collateral damage and civilian casualties on the battlefield, or has it actually pushed it in the opposite direction? Or do you not even have enough quantifiable data to back up a position either way on that?
So, wow, that was a lot that you said. No, it's fine. So before I answer this direct question, I would just like to just clarify that there is a proliferation of armed conflict, but we have to also be a bit careful about separating that from situations of violence, which doesn't cross the threshold of armed conflict. And the reason why I'm mentioning that is because the legal framework, which is international humanitarian law or the law of armed conflict, which most militaries refer to it as, has more permissive rules to use force, lethal force, against a military objective or a combatant. Yeah. So whereas when there's other situations of violence, it's a very context-specific analysis, and there's a whole legal analysis that leads to that. So in other situations of violence, human rights law is applicable where the use of force is more restricted. So you don't use lethal force to kill, but you detain, capture, arrest, under law force. So I just want to be very clear, that kind of analysis is useful, is very important. So we don't have this blurring of the lines between more permissive rules where IHL only applies in armed conflict or in other situations of violence where the human rights law framework is applicable.
Yeah.
Again, I'm a stickler, I'm a lawyer, but
it should be.
But it does, because it does matter, because, civilians cannot be directly targeted when armed conflict occurs. And unless, again, they are they are found based on their actions and et cetera to be directly participating in hostilities. And that's another problem set that has come up a lot in warfare in the last couple of decades, is especially in asymmetric warfare. But even what we are seeing currently, another major battle that's, you know, between Russia and Ukraine, about like this blurring of lines between civilians and combatants. Like, again, the different roles, as you also mentioned about technology, is like, you know, especially in the cyber domain, for example, like, yeah. People are in, you know, defending their country or, you know, support their country's political and military objectives, and all these hackers online, and like, mm-hmm. what are they doing exactly that is considered as an attack under armed conflict? You know, yeah. the spreading of malware. Mm-hmm. Into another country's cyber domain, and that takes the hospitals offline because the electric power grid is being turned off, you know, is not working, or, you know, and then so civilians could, you know, patients don't have access to urgent medical care. And so there are all of these issues that are also happening in armed conflict. And again, since you mentioned technology, that we have to be very careful of, like, what is an attack? How can you address some of the risks in these, with the use of all of this technology? And again, some of the cyber stuff is, you know, dual use space, right? Militaries yep. and civilians are using the same networks and telecommunications and the whole ICT framework. And how do you build in the resiliency to protect your, cyber domain from attacks, you know, given the examples of, you know, the power grids, the infrastructure, hospitals that we all sort of rely on these dual uses. How do you spread from malware? And again, who is spreading this malware in this country, and are they then contributing to the war effort and compromising the yeah. protection from attacks? So these are very complex issues that are also occurring again with technology, et cetera. And this, that's something to be sort of be cognizant of. And to your question about precision, so of course the legal framework is, and again, the law requires that any means of methods of warfare, you know, have to be governed by the principles of IHL, you know, distinction, proportionality, precautions, balancing military necessity with humanity. And I won't go into all the legal stuff, but I think that, you know, it is better to use more precise weapons and smaller ordnance and warheads in cities and densely populated areas, because all the data has shown that when using unguided munitions, wide area effects weapons, you know, your multiple barrel rockets, your massive 2,000-pound bombs in densely populated areas, the scale of destruction, again, homes, schools, whatever's in the area, civilians that are in the area, all going to get impacted. So right. the if you do have PGMs and you do have them, it is a preferable way, right? In order to even be compliant with IHL, because they are more guided, and you can, you know, direct the effects more in a more targeted way. But again, going to your question, you still have to do the as an attacking force, you still have to do the assessments of, and all of your, you know, intelligence preparation of the battlefield still has to take into account, in deploying these munitions, the PGMs, that are civilians in the area, how far, and again, the challenge in urban areas where civilian and civilian objects' proximity to military objectives is very close. So what are you doing in your IPB, your intel prep of the battlefield, to fully understand the civilian environment where civilians could be present, where civilian objects are, and then decide how to, you know, again, use these munitions. And so I think that kind of aperture of analysis, and you and I have talked about this also, like the whole IPB phase is very much seen from the lens of, you know, getting information about the adversary. And it doesn't necessarily have that broader analysis on where civilians are present. Right. Of course, you know, a lot of militaries, including the US and others, you know, a lot of the NATO countries have, you know, no strike lists, and they go through the weaponeering process and using the ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance technology, to see patterns of life, etc. But there are still gaps in that analysis. And so again, in using PGMs, you still have to do that analysis. And just because you use it doesn't mean that that civilian incidental harm doesn't occur, right? So that's why I have a hard time with the whole precision terminology, because the law also recognizes that incidental harm occurs. It is the onus for the attacking and the defending force to move civilians from the area, try to identify the risks, and take the appropriate, use the appropriate means and methods of warfare to minimize the risk to civilians.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I find, like, I understand that, you know, but I think that it's often used, the phrase precision, like Western states often use that term when they announce something they've done or something they're going to do, as though it's obviating any kind of concern associated with ineffectiveness around collateral damage, ineffectiveness around the effect of the strike, anything like that. And so it always, like, it just strikes me as a silly thing to tie on to, a silly adjective to tie on to any kind of pronouncement of a strike. Like, oh, we use precision strike to do X. Like, who cares? Just say we struck X, you know, and here was the effect. But it's, I think it's almost inferring that your audience is being lulled to sleep by that term, and they're like, oh, okay, so it's inherently better. The other thing that you had mentioned that I thought was worth commenting on too is, you know, sometimes, and again, this is a hypothetical just based off what you were talking about, you know, the civilians being tucked into different places doing different, you know, dual use military things. One of the things that I think, and I've seen some reports on this, is, you know, the civilians building drones that are then used on the battlefield. And so if you have civilians, let's say in Ukraine, building drones in an apartment complex, that are, you know, then turned around and given to the military, is that apartment complex then, you know, a justifiable target because it's manufacturing hardware that's being used by the military? And so there's many, like, slippery slopes. And then, you know, you see on the news an apartment complex gets hit with a Russian missile, and then, you know, the Ukrainians are crying foul. And again, I'm all for Ukraine winning this conflict. I think that they are, you know, on the right side of everything on this, but it's just one of those situations where it's, you know, it's there's a lot of gray area, like you pointed out, with the hackers and other things. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think the gray area is always has been
around
forever. I mean, I think when I just sometimes picture, like, how would we react if somebody is attacking us, right? Your knee jerk is like, I have to protect my family. And so you do everything to protect. But I think what needs to be done is this sort of, and again, the decision to participate in some sort of a war effort, it's like either, you know, manufacturing the munitions or providing intel on attacking forces or troop movements, et cetera, in an app that, you know, a country's intel service can use for targeting or defending or whatever. I'm just, you know, throwing out examples.
Yep.
Is that there's also that you know, this kind of awareness raising that civilians who do this, they may compromise. Again, there's a whole legal analysis. Countries and militaries decide who is directly participating in hostilities, just like the U.S. has that in their DoD law war manual. And again, that's one of the requirements under IHL, that you should do a fact-based analysis.
You should celebrate yourself every day. But some days, you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
For that, because the framework is, the legal framework is more protective, right? So civilians also need to understand that if they do X, Y, and Z, that what they're doing could compromise their, could compromise their immunity from attack. But again, yeah, it's a very fact-to-fact basis. And I know that there's, in some countries, when this blurring of the line is happening, like there are efforts on educating people and then also, you know, engaging with the armed actors, saying, try to, separate yourself from the civilian population, wear certain insignia that knows that you would be, that you are a combatant and you could be lawfully targeted, and don't co-locate with civilians. Don't co-locate in civilian objects that are, again, civilian objects like religious institution places and medical facilities and personnel are all protected under the law. No. So I think there's a lot of education that sort of this ongoing education that needs to be sort of done both with armed actors and with civilians on these issues. But it is, again, civilians have agency. They decide how they want to help their nation or their particular political strategy or whatever, or how they want to move their families to safety and what they want to do. So, and there's also the strategic arguments, right, to make. I mean, again, I've spoken to lots of different militaries who, who are like, well, they could have left that area. They're probably sympathetic to the adversary. And I was like, no, you can't just say an entire population.
Right.
Is the supports the adversary, and then you can engage. And there's that whole collective punishment attitude, deprive food, water to the entire population because they could have. Why did they choose to have this armed actor govern the area? Civilians sometimes don't have a choice, right?
Right.
So we can't live in this lawless environment, because we've seen time and time again tactical choices that armed actors make and how they prosecute wars, either when they're defending or attacking, has strategic outcomes. And you either prolong the war, you create more animosity towards you as a nation or an armed actor, or you have civilians support the adversary because you are just blowing everything up and denying them access to food, water, and to be able to survive. And again, the way you're prosecuting the war. So it's, but I know I don't want to sound all depressing. It is, but there's also all of this learning and examining battles are happening also allows us to say we can do better and how we innovate in this area.
Yeah, so real quick, a question on a tactic, and then I'm going to move off on to something else. So the idea of, I've heard about this before, and I've seen stuff, and I've written a tiny bit because it's really hard to find anything about it that's any kind of got any depth. But what about this this tactic of roof knocking that apparently the Israelis have developed and have tried to use? And it's the idea that you pop a PGM over the top of a target to give the non-combatants a heads up so that they clear out, and then you strike the target at some point thereafter with another PGM. Have you found that that's actually an effective tactic at all, or is it what does your research say on that?
So the law requires that attacking forces have to, if it's feasible, to give effective warning to the civilian population, so that they have the option to move to safety. And the thing is, the language is effective and feasible, right? So putting out SMS or calling or leaflets or whatever methods that, and also with technology, et cetera, whichever methods you want to use to communicate to the civilian population that, hey, we are coming. Again, has to be like, how is it going to be received by that population in a way, language they understand, in time, enough time for them to make a decision whether they can go safe, move to a place of safety, is also important to evaluate whether this is even effective. Just doing it and it still results in civilian harm because where people were told to go to doesn't have any food, water, medicine, sanitation, and then those areas also being bombed means like these are ineffective, right? So, yeah. So I think every case. Every recent conflict, especially since more data is coming out, like if you look at, you know, some of these approaches in Iraq or in Syria also, what was done to encourage, you know, because forced displacement is prohibited under IHL. So, so either you encourage people to leave. And again, it is their choice if they leave. You know, the whole evacuation aspect of things and you're just sort of warning them that these attacks would happen and how they can move to an area of safety. But again, even if the assumption, again, the data that's come out that even if you do provide a warning, doesn't mean that civilians are able to leave. You still, from a legal lens, are still have to take into account the principle of distinguishing civilians and combatants in the area and civilian objects and what munitions, how big your payload and your bomb is that you're going to be using to engage a military objective that is very close to where civilians are present. So all of that analysis still is there, even if you used a tactic and said, oh, I'm putting a warning out and that's it. My obligation is over under the law. These are actually, to be honest with you, these are very fundamental legal areas in terms of, how this requirement on the law is being applied. So, you know, just doing it doesn't mean it was effective if the consequence still was that civilians died or civilian objects were blown up or whatever.
What trends have you seen emerge in warfare that you found troubling for the future of mitigating civilian harm and collateral damage on the future battlefield?
So I think that most militaries are not, and countries and armed actors still have a lot to learn on understanding all the risks that do take place, especially in populated areas, right? And how are they? What capabilities do they have to assess those risks? And again, I'm not talking about always using advanced technology, etc. Because as we've seen, you know, we've been very used to as the U.S. also, but other that. There's you have advantage with air superiority that you own the skies, but as you've seen in Russia Ukraine situation, mm-hmm. that you know, just relying on technology as the panacea to help you do all of your information gathering is just not going to work because there's jamming going on. There's your GPS signals are not going to work in an urban canyon, you know, with the tall buildings, yep. and this whole thing of like, oh, technology is there. And we just rely on that the thinking has to shift both from politicians and practitioners, military practitioners. And you have to, you know, continue to use all sources of information, including human intelligence and OSINT, et cetera, to better understand where civilians are moving. It's such a dynamic environment, you know, where the military objective is and that constant and now where the essential services are located. And again, for law-abiding militaries and armed actors, that is the kind of risk analysis approach that has to be taken in order to come up with mitigation measures to try to, you know, again, reduce incidental harm. And I think another area that is to me is again that we're still, and people are not trained to fight in populated areas and in urban areas. I think that still is an area that needs to improve because it's hard to replicate in urban areas. So, you know, what can be done through immersive technology, VR and virtual reality, or, you know, doing TTXs with complex problems? Because again, the expectation that civilians are going to leave is just not shown with all the data that's come out different conflicts and so even in LISCO, right, large-scale combat operations, as an attacking force, you know, let's say, I mean, I know you love to, you've written a lot on sieges and encirclements. Yep. So that's your pet project and all the data. Okay, so, you know, you and I have discussed this too. Like, if you're going to, sieges are lawful, yes, and it gives you military advantage, if it's being directed at the adversary. But as an attacking force, you cannot deny food, water, medicine, basic things for people to survive, the civilians to survive. And as you've seen most recently, even fuel. Fuel is needed to run the hospital. So again, doing a siege, that means who's suffering also. And again, it is a complicated fact-based analysis. But again, as a from a civilian protection harm mitigation approach, you have to take these into account and plan for the fact that if you cannot, that you need to allow some food, you know, you need to allow adequate food, water, medicine to come in for the civilian population to survive. And either you provide it or you allow neutral humanitarian actors to come in and provide it. And because that is that you cannot starve the civilian population. And again, the some of the decisions that one makes in the beginning of the phase, or, you know, saying, oh, you have 24 hours to evacuate. I mean, there's no data that shows that you can safely evacuate people in 24 hours and or cut off all telecommunications, even like telecommunications. Like, again, like going back to your example about the warning, if the telecommunication has been cut off and all the towers are damaged or destroyed, like how are even people getting information? Right. So for to move to safety or even to find out where their loved ones are, or they may be buried under rubble. So, you know, all of these things are sort of really important from, again, from a planner's lens, thinking through all of these risks and offering sort of alternatives, mitigation measures. And then I think another issue with trends in warfare, and again, with technology, et cetera, there's this, if we, you know, we've discussed a little bit on the cyber stuff, but also information warfare. Again, IO has been, information warfare has been around since war, but now there is so much with, you know, disinformation that is, we are again seeing some of the data coming out with recent conflict is, if civilians are, have been told to move to an area where it is safer for them, and there's a disinformation campaign through what through whatever social media chats, etc., and they're misdirected to a different location. That means they are in harm's way, and they can't access food, water, or they may get injured or killed. Right. So there are examples of those happening in current conflicts. So, and everything is spreading so fast with technology, and the digitization of everything means, oh, that's the other thing, is everything's also a sensor, right? So, so again, there's a lot of from a legal lens, from a risk analysis lens, all of these have to be taken into account. Then also the issue of space, right? Everything is like, there are private companies that have satellites on space that we are using. You know, we know one big, which private company is out there and yep. Yeah, their satellite is being used. And one country and adversary can say, oh, well, I can target this satellite because it's helping the war effort for this for my adversary. And that, again, all of those things, you know, these sort of blurring of the lines and risks, and we just cannot be in this lawless environment. And we also have to, going back, when I think about civilian harm mitigation and civilian protection, it's like there's a legal analysis as a baseline, and then seeing there's a legal, ethical, and strategic priority, which is in terms of civilian protection, harm mitigation, which is really important to sort of identify all those risks and think through better planning and mitigation measures to not have to reduce some of the horrific data that we are getting on a daily basis when civilians are caught up in war.
A lot of the stuff you raised there ties into the last question I have for you, and that's a technology and future of war question. And so given the push to see an increase in drones and autonomous systems on future battlefields, what do you think, what challenges do you think that will arise with that technology as it relates to minimizing collateral damage and civilian harm on the battlefield in the future?
So with all of these emerging technologies and autonomous systems, and I think, A, there has to be the legal and ethical framework guidelines analysis in the deployment and use. So again, law being the first, and then all the ethics, right? Yeah. And I do think that even just, this is more on the AI side, artificial intelligence, right? How, like, you know, there's so much data that's coming in from all sources, you know, for a military commander to do analysis. So there could be some ways that, for example, AI and can be leveraged to better analyze some of the data. But again, like what are the algorithms that are feeding into that data? What you're putting in is what you're also going to get out. So again, there are all of these sort of questions and frameworks and guidelines that have to be applied when we're using AI and decision making for targeting, et cetera. But also there could be some really positive uses, like, the imagery that was obtained as part of the collateral damage estimate on day 15, but then on day 16, you're going to be using that to prosecute the strike. But, can we get updated imagery then? And can the AI help in seeing the difference between the day 15 imagery to day 16? So there could be from the lens of, there are more civilians present here, or the military objective has moved. I mean, there could be these positive uses of AI too. And then the other example, of course, is on this issue of autonomous and autonomous weapons. Again, it is very important that states continue to ensure that human judgment and human is in the loop because of all the risks that do come from, using lethal force. And, what is the mechanism what is the data that is being fed into that particular weapon system that allows it to engage a target, a military objective, and if it's completely autonomous, I think the risks are pretty significant. So even U.S. policy currently is, and I think there's a new DoD instruction 3000.9 that sort of states, example, U.S. government position on autonomous and semi-autonomous capabilities, including, human judgment as being part of the process. So I think for a lot of countries are concerned about this, and there are a lot of different efforts underway in Europe and in parts of Asia, et cetera, and then also through the UN about the guardrails on using this technology in order to be compliant with the law of armed conflict.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And that aligns a lot with what I've heard from other people as I've discussed this topic with them, looking at the future of armed conflict. All right, so Sahar, that's all I have for you today. I appreciate your time. Is there anything else you have that you would like to say before we close out today?
Yes, I think that I want to end on a more of a positive, optimistic note. because yes, the things are pretty stark and pretty it's hard getting up every day and seeing the data that's coming out on what's happening across in a lot of different countries and how civilians are being impacted, but there's also innovation that's happening. There are also efforts at a multilateral level as well as by some countries to do better to minimize civilian harm, and the U.S. government has this new Department of Defense instruction on civilian harm mitigation. It's on the DoD website. It has a very extensive action plan about how to do better, and it's seen as a legal, ethical, and a strategic priority to reduce, minimize civilian harm. And there's a whole framework on how to sort of do this. There are other efforts that are going on. At a multilateral level, some people, and you and I have talked about this too, about, the explosive weapons in populated area initiative. Sure. I believe 83 or 84 countries have endorsed this declaration, which is, just geared more for, these unguided, wide area effects weapons when they're used in populated areas and what can be done to try to, limit their use in these areas, just because the devastation scale of harm is so enormous. And some of the language in there, some of the best practices or good practices or approaches In that. So I think there's a lot of awareness raising exchanges going on. I know the Dutch government has their civilian protection policy. Of course, the United Nations and the peacekeeping operations has their protection of civilians policy and civilian harm mitigation approach. NATO has a protection of civilians policies. There are also other countries at a national level working with the civil society on putting protection of civilians as a key priority for their militaries and governments. And I think all of these exchanges and how we study conflict brings a lot of rich data for us to be more informed on how we can improve. So I think that's I want to, you know, end on that kind of note that there are efforts. It's a constant journey, you know, for us. Yeah. I've been working on these issues for two decades now. But we've seen that when some of these measures are applied, at least a reduction of civilian harm. And I think that's a good data point and positive approach to sort of think about, you know, moving forward.
When we talk and when I think about what it is you do and what you work on and you and your colleagues work on, the metaphor of an individual pushing a rock up a hill is always what comes to mind. But then when I think more about it, I think an individual pushing a rock uphill while it's raining and the hill's all muddy and slippery is probably a better analogy for that. So anyhow, again, thank you, Sahar, for your time. I appreciate it. And it's been great to talk to you again.
No, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you for listening to the Revolution in Military Affairs podcast. We know that there are a lot of other podcasts out there competing for your time, and we appreciate you sharing your time with us. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you would share this on social media. We would also appreciate it if you would provide us a rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. These ratings help new listeners find the podcast. Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.